Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, April 3rd, 2017. More than 40 South Sudanese with dual citizenship have been evacuated from the country following efforts by the U.S. government.
When the ceasefire broke down, Dr. Mashar's group was driven out of town by the armed conflict. And so there were apprehensions, both on the part of the folks in the camp, as well as on the part of the government. You know, who was in the camp were those folks who had fought against the government.
And South Sudan suspends higher work permit fees after widespread criticism.
We are higher in the first category, but in the second and the third, we are consistent with the region.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The U.S. Embassy in South Sudan says it has facilitated the departure of 42 South Sudanese holding dual citizenship passports from the United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. These South Sudanese have been living at a UN-run protection of civilian camp in Juba since July last year. Most of them say their affiliation with former first vice president Riek Machar put their lives in danger of arrest if they left the camp. Ayen Beer has more from Washington.
The group got their paperwork straightened out and boarded a chartered plane on Saturday to Cyprus. The process of facilitating their departure took months, according to American Ambassador Mary Catherine or Molly Fee. She says it was time-consuming work because of the different governments involved and the sensitivities involved in Juba's political climate.
When the ceasefire broke down, Dr. Mashar's group was driven out of town by the armed conflict. And so passions were inflamed, and there were apprehensions, both on the part of the folks in the camp as well as on the part of the government. You know, who was in the camp were those folks who had fought against the government. So over time, those passions subsided, and we were able to gain the support of the first vice president.
Fee is referring to first vice president Taban Dengai, who was appointed to replace Mashar after Mashar fled the country in July. Most of the men who boarded the plane to Cyprus came to Juba after the August 2015 peace deal was signed as part of Mashar's advance team. In July, when the deadly fighting erupted, they say they were left with no choice but to flee to POC3. They say they could not evacuate with the other Westerners at that time because there were too many government checkpoints leading to the airport and the risk of being identified as a member of Mashar's SPLAIO inner sanctum was too high. The only option was to flee to the IDP camp, where they would ask their Western embassies for help. That help finally came in the form of Saturday's chartered plane. But some men could not wait for the Americans' help. Boutros Chan-Ten, a dual Australian national who lived in the same IDP camp, was smuggled out of the country in January with the help of a friend who works for South Sudan's National Security Service. Speaking from Kampala, Uganda, Chan says the only reason he and other Westerners stayed at the POC camp for months was security concerns.
For you to be safe, you have to walk out from the POC and then you declare that I am supporting Taban Dengai, who is now the first vice president. And in the absence of that, then you make sure whatever you do, if you are out, which one are you belong to? You cannot just, someone like you, you cannot just come out in Juba and then stay.
Taban Dengai spokesman Chol Lam disputes that claim, insisting Mashar's men could have left at any time.
There are political motivations within their supporters. So if somebody has relatives or have any supporters within the POC site, they would want them to stay in the site so that they have leverage in negotiating with the government or any other body, maybe for assistance or maybe for political gain.
Chan says the only pressure he faced came from the government. He says he refused to change his allegiance to Guy and grew weary of waiting for the Americans' help to leave.
You cannot be a sympathizer or supporter of Machar and then walking in Juba freely. This is impossible. You cannot do that. If his supporters, if they're not inside the national security premises, they are in unison. They cannot walk in Dubai Street. No, they cannot. Unless you do that underground. People, his soldiers are in the bush. This is one. The other sympathizers are inside the POCs.
Ambassador Fee says the first vice president's office assisted with the departure. Lam says in an effort to provide their support for the departing group, the government provided transportation for the Western IDPs to Juba International Airport. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
Ugandan authorities and relief agencies are worried about increasing number of unaccompanied South Sudanese children in refugee camps. They say it's hard to reunite the children with their families, and most of them end up in foster care. Many South Sudanese continue to flee the country due to ongoing fighting and famine in some areas. Catherine Nambi reports for VOA from Kampala.
15-year-old Nyalok Susan fled from her home in Juba after she was threatened to be killed if she stayed in her home. Susan from Central Equatorial Province says neighbors told her Danuel would tell them to leave their homes. And she says Samuel told them they would not spare anyone, including children and orphans.
We came from a school to home. I didn't find my uncle, my auntie. One of my neighbors told me that it wanted that you not to stay at home. We go somewhere. We went up to Gure. We stayed there for 3 days. Nuer used to get out of South Sudan from Juba. They told us that they don't want to live together here again. Anyway, which is empty, you have to go to that country, because when we are going to come back again, we may not select this one is an orphan, this one is a young children.
Susan is not alone. 15-year-old Mabiol Lois narrates how life became difficult after renewed fighting in July forced her to find refuge in Uganda.
My mom is all dead, but my auntie was there in Pagrenya too. I'm here alone. At home I live it because there is no somebody there, and the life is difficult. That's why I come here, to save my life.
According to UN Refugee Agency UNHCR, two-thirds of South Sudanese refugees in Uganda are children under the age of 18 years, and most of these arrive at the refugee transit centers and are accompanied by a parent or adult. Some of the children are placed under the foster care of other refugees to ensure they have an adult to rely on while in the camps. Charlie Ali is the external relations officer at UNHCR.
It's clear this is a children's emergency. It's children that are being forced to flee their homes, often because of attacks in the middle of the night, that are being forced to walk through the bush for days, if not weeks, without access to food or water. And it's children that are being deprived of their right to a normal life. The UNHCR are here working with the government and our partners to help those children that have been separated from their parents to be reunited with those parents if they're already here somewhere in Uganda or in the region. And in the meantime, they're being provided with foster care as well as critical life-saving assistance such as food, water and a roof over their heads.
Catherine Nakazi, a Uganda Red Cross Society official, says tracing the families of the children is challenging, but they are working with other agencies to ensure the children are united with their families.
Some of them don't have any telephone contact, so that process takes time, but we have to make sure we go through that process until we get their family people and unite them. In partnership with the Red Cross Family Tracing Unit in Sudan, we get to know their family members.
Uganda is currently home to over 800,000 South Sudan refugees. A majority of them fled renewed fighting in July between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar. 886 new arrivals have been recorded daily between 15th and 28th March, and 64% of these are children, some as young as 4 years old. About 400 unaccompanied minors have been reported in the various South Sudan refugee camps in Uganda, a number said to be overwhelming as far as provision of basic services as well as finding parents, guardians and foster homes is concerned. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
After widespread criticism, the government of South Sudan has dropped plans to increase work permit fees charged to foreigners. Earlier last month, Juba announced work permits for professionals and business class would cost $10,000 instead of $300, and fees for blue-collar workers would raise to $2,000 from $150. Casual workers would pay $1,000 instead of $100 for a work permit. Government committee reviewed the matter and recommended the fee be comparable to other countries in the region. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
Government officials said they were running out of money, so in early March they released a circular announcing the dramatically higher work permit fees, but the new fees were never implemented. Finance Minister Stephen Diu Dao told the reporters over the weekend the government committee reviewing the increased fees found that the work permit fees South Sudan would have charged for the professional and business class category of foreign workers were much higher than those of other East African countries.
We are higher in the first category, but in the second and the third, we are consistent with the region.
Dao says the committee has proposed a new fee for professional or business class workers but did not disclose that amount. He says the increased work permit fee for skilled and non-skilled laborers or blue-collar workers and casual workers will stay the same, which is in line with the fees other countries charge. Dao says the government has also suspended the implementation of aircraft landing fees, which were supposed to be increased from $150 to $4,000 per aircraft.
We observe that these fees are relatively higher comparing with the region. So the Minister of Transport had issued a directive to suspend the imposition of this rate temporary till the act it is reviewed. The fees that are being charged by the Minister of Trade on diesel and petrol also is among the highest rates, and this also has been suspended temporary. And the collecting agencies will continue with the old rate.
Dao says a financial act passed by Parliament earlier this year also increased taxes on agriculture and health sectors. Dao says the taxes have been reviewed and a new tax structure will be forthcoming. South Sudan Deputy Finance Minister Mo Ambrose Thick chaired the review committee. He says the committee quickly realized the new charges contradict some government policies and would have hurt the economy.
For example, we have seen that medicines were being given, people were living 5%. We have reduced this 5% to 1%. And we are trying to look at the policy of the government, because all the rates are supposed to be closely related to the policies of the government. For example, the president has called for engagement more in agriculture. So what we do, when we look at the rates, there is 10% in some of those agriculture equipments. We have reduced them to 5.
Dao says the review committee's new proposals should be incorporated into the financial act soon. He says the government will make interim arrangements under which taxpayers can sign an undertaking note until the new rates are ratified by Parliament. Pius Ojara, secretary of the South Sudan NGO Forum, welcomes the government's decision on lowering work permit fees.
We have been engaging with government to make the case that the humanitarians are committed to South Sudan, and we would appreciate any effort and support that humanitarians get to facilitate their ability to support emergency response to the population in need. So I would say that this comes as a great relief.
Ian Ridley, who heads the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or UN OCHA, in South Sudan, says he too welcomes the new fees, but says UN OCHA has yet to receive any official confirmation from the government.
Of course, we're very pleased to hear that the government's made this move, but I don't really want to say much more until we've seen the official circular.
Dao says the new fees and taxes are expected to be presented to Cabinet for approval this week. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, officials in Boma State say parts of the Juba-Pibor Road remains dangerous. We'll bring you more details after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's the best advice you would give to a child?
The best advice I can give to a child, more especially here in Africa, is that we need to work hard in class and we need to be focused on our future, what we can be after finishing our education.
Best advice I would give is to follow each and everything that the guardian advises him or her.
I think to be disciplined and try to work as hard as possible in his education and even be very practical, actually, because what we are living in today, people will get very a long way forward when they are very practical.
Working hard, being persistent, yeah. Because the way Uganda is at this point, we have to work hard. We have to be so persistent on what we like.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Boma State authorities say the road linking the Juba to Pibor remains blocked after six aid workers were killed along that road. Officials say the road closure are hampering delivery of humanitarian aid to hundreds of thousands of people in urgent need. Tito Justin has more for VOA from Juba.
After the UN mission in South Sudan confirmed that six aid workers were ambushed and killed March 25th in a government-controlled area, Boma State officials say their area remains inaccessible to aid workers because of armed youth from Jonglei attacking vehicles along the roads. Boma State Information Minister John Achon says the Juba-Pibor road remains impassable and people in the state capital Pibor who depend on relief aid humanitarian agencies are suffering.
We need help. And also you need the road to be open. We don't want road block. As the Boma said, we don't want road block because now people they don't get food, they don't get medicine, they don't get water. It means these people which is close the road, they want to kill the civilian.
Minister Achon says security agents investigating deadly attacks on the road indicates the gunmen who killed the six aid workers a little more than a week ago are from Jonglei State.
According to the information that we got from the security, that the car is going to the road of Jonglei, to the military barrack, which is going to the Jonglei. So that's why we got the information that this car is taken to Bor.
Achon is urging all sides to adhere to the peace agreement Jonglei and Boma State officials signed last year to restore peace in the area. Jonglei State officials deny armed youth from their area are behind the attack along Juba-Pibor Road. Jonglei State Information Minister Akech Deng says insecurity along the road worsened after Boma State authorities deployed hundreds of armed men along the road in their territory. He says improving security on the Juba-Pibor Road must be the responsibility of Jonglei, Boma, and Terkeka authorities working together.
From Bo to Juba or Juba to Bo, it's a public road and there are five partners which should be responsible for this road. It's then Boma State, it's Juba State, it's Terekeka, Jonglei, and the national government or national army to patrol the road. Now they have stationed their 230 youth to attack the vehicle. Today only, since morning up to now, they have attacked five vehicles.
Deng is calling on the international community to intervene before insecurity escalates.
This is not right, and we are calling on the UN and national government. This thing is getting out of hand. It should be handled right away and immediately. Well, if it's not handled, what do you think? There will be more deaths.
Ayuen Gwet Ror, a spokesman for the Jonglei State Youth Association, denies youth from his area killed an aid worker. He says armed Jonglei State youth are working to protect their cattle from cattle rustlers and child abductors from Boma State.
They are not our youth. We have no problem with international community. We have no problem with aid workers. They are for help, to help people of South Sudan. Only our problem is the issue of cattle and child abduction. If they return it back, we have no problem. Ours is not a national duty. It is our own duty as youth of Bor for the cattle keepers and the children.
Jonglei and Boma State officials say gunmen continue to attack vehicles moving along the Juba-Pibor Road. Last week, aid workers said they would continue providing humanitarian assistance to needy people in remote parts of South Sudan, despite the harsh environment under which they operate. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Cameroon's government says secessionist groups in English-speaking regions are behind arson attacks on public buildings. The most recent attack was on a large market in the town of Limbe. The fires are prompting renewed calls for dialogue to end the five-month-long strike in the English-speaking areas. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Limbe, Cameroon.
The fire at Limbe Market burned for 4 hours Saturday. 50 shops were destroyed. The governor of the Southwest region, Bernard Okalia Bilai, said police arrested a suspect believed to belong to a secessionist group.
The suspect has already denounced many of his accomplices, and those who are in a way or another linked to this act of terrorism will be answered. We want to call the population of the Southwest back to peace, and I want to reassure the population of Limbe, the administration is there with the forces of law to protect them.
The fire at Limbe Market points to the dangers and the cost of the deepening impasse in Cameroon's two English-speaking zones. Lawyers and teachers in those areas, the Northwest and the Southwest, have been on strike since November. Most schools in the affected zones remain closed and business is paralyzed. The strikers are demanding reforms to counter what they say is the overwhelming use of French in the bilingual country. But while some strikers are demanding a return to federalism, other activists are calling for total independence for the English-speaking zones, ratcheting up tensions and violence. Several schools, private residences, police stations, administrative buildings have been burned. No one has claimed responsibility. Lawmaker Eno Tanjong from the Southwest region addressed his fellow senators on March 13.
I would like to point out and castigate the arson that ravaged the Faculty of Medicine of the University in Bamenda and the destruction of the administrative block of the government high school, Akwaya. The political elite, religious figures, members of the civil society, traditional rulers have all joined the head of state in appealing for dialogue and peace.
Visiting Bamenda in the northwest 2 weeks ago, Cameroon's prime minister called the destruction an attempt to exert pressure on the government. In response, the government has cut internet to affected zones and made arrests. That includes three community leaders charged in relation to the violent unrest in December. If convicted, they could face the death penalty, according to Cameroon's 2014 anti-terrorism law. Negotiations to end the strike fell apart when the state refused the strikers' demand to release everyone currently detained. Lawmaker Joseph Banadzam of the opposition Social Democratic Front is calling for compromise.
Government and the strikers should come back to the negotiating table. And I think one of the conditions which they are requesting is the release of those who are negotiating with government who have been caught and brought to Yaoundé. Peace has no price. We should be able to have some amnesty, release these people, and let school start.
President Paul Biya has on several public outings declared that he is open for dialogue, but that he is not ready to release arrested suspects and that he is not open for any discussions that call into question national unity. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Limbe, Cameroon.
A South African court has ruled adults can illegally grow and use their own marijuana at home. The ruling still has to go through the nation's top court and does not allow free-for-all use of the substance. But pro-marijuana activists are hailing it as a victory in the eventual legalization and social acceptance of the controversial substance. VOA's Anita Paul reports from Johannesburg.
The recent court ruling allowing home use of marijuana has sent South Africa buzzing about the possibility the herb will be widely legal in the Rainbow Nation. But pro-marijuana activist Julian Staub says, chill. Friday's ruling from the Western Cape Province High Court applies across the nation, but the decision is more about privacy than it is about pot. The ruling struck down part of a law that prohibits private and personal use of marijuana. The ruling still has to be solidified by Parliament and passed through the Constitutional Court, which could take up to 2 years. South Africa first criminalized marijuana in 1908. Police statistics say drug-related arrests have recently risen to nearly 260,000, according to the most recent annual crime report. That is about 13% of all arrests. In 2010, police raided Staub's home, and he was arrested for marijuana possession. He was later released. Under the ruling, Staub says, cases like his will not occur anymore.
So, if you are using cannabis for the privacy of your own home, or indeed, if you have grown cannabis in the privacy of your home and it's never left the building, you now have a loophole in the law that if you do get arrested and you do go in front of a magistrate, you can use the defense that you were hurting nobody. There was no victim. There was no crime. There's no black market. There are no transactions. No one's making money out of this. You are using the cannabis you grew in the privacy of your own home.
But buying and selling marijuana is still illegal, as is smoking in public. Few anti-marijuana activists made their voices heard to protest the move. One online group called South Africans Against Dacha and Satan, Dacha is the local slang for cannabis, said on social media the day of the ruling would forever be known as the day Satan took over South Africa. Users of the drug for religious purposes, like those in the Rastafarian community, say they welcome the news. In February, South Africa's government approved a bill that would allow for the limited manufacturing of medical marijuana. Staub says he hopes these are just first steps in the eventual regulation and decriminalization of marijuana, like in the U.S. state of Colorado. Marijuana is now legal in 28 U.S. states for either medical or recreational use.
That's exactly what we see. And we see billions of rand going back into the treasury in taxation on the plant. Because we're not asking for legalization. We're asking for the legalization and regulation of the plant. This doesn't come with a free-for-all. It is a free-for-all now. We're trying to stop the free-for-all, and it's legalized regulation that we're after.
Staub says he and his partner spent the weekend after the ruling celebrating at home. For the first time, he says, legally. Anita Paul, VOA News, Johannesburg.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Bandito by Emmanuel Camilo, who sings in his native Balanda language.
Ndakateba kontang nangai tiwana teno yo bandito ninde. Ndakateba kontang nangapanga wana teno yo bandito ninde. Modi wello di sine bivanga. Modi wello di sine birunga. Modi wello di sine bota. Modi wello kere neri taibano me. Ndakaba matino ninde. Modi wello kere neri taibano me. Dakapa matino ni ninde
ani da ngo damru ngo tarango no
dene no sono ti de kada uta bano
anga soy ni meditaize wi
my vi na de no pinga nda uta bindi funo badir yo no ai tuta kitito tele no bandito duta matani.
We have been listening to Emmanuel Camilo with the song Bandito. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could be here, and we invite you to join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Mm-hmm.
dotizi yandu nazo kenea tafu.